Hello, everybody. This is your host, Jim, again, of the Bible Study Podcast, and here we're going to start episode 45, the philosophical evidence for God. As I mentioned before, this episode, the previous one, and the following one are all based on notes that I've used and already acted on when I shared in a city near me in Oberlin, Ohio, in some evangelism efforts to attempt to persuade people to the faith. And so some of the arguments that you're going to hear today, some of the evidences, so to speak, for God, are not going to be purely philosophical. They'll be historical, they'll be scientific, there will be you could say comparative religion type arguments. And while I could easily just keep the episodes confined to their single topics, again, my effort here when I was putting these notes together was when I went downtown, which is on a weekly basis for 3 straight weeks, on a Saturday evening to evangelize and tell people why I think they should believe in Jesus. It was with the assumption that I was not guaranteed to be able to get the exact same crowd every single time. And so while each message has a focus on philosophy, science, or history, which would be the three, that I included a little bit of everything in each one, so that way somebody who was hearing it, potentially the whole thing, heard scientific evidence for God, philosophical evidence for God, and historical evidence for God. So if you've listened to the episode 44, the scientific evidence for God, you will no doubt hear some of the same arguments that I expressed there. If you're listening today for the first time and you want to go and dig deeper, I would definitely refer you to episode 44. If you're just interested in the philosophical arguments for the existence of God, then feel free to stay listening in, but you're going to get a little bit of the others while it's going to focus on philosophy. So with that being said, I'll get going. When I was 9 years old, my grandfather passed away. He was my last living grandparent at the time, and I remember when he passed, in the weeks that followed, I was, as a young boy, trying to process what had happened at that point. And it was obviously kind of difficult to really process the first, like, real death of somebody that I knew. And while I remember in those moments, I was very hurt, sad, angry, and I ended up asking, the question, God, why did you let this happen to me? Why did you let this happen to him? Why did you let this happen to our family? And while as a 9-year-old, not having any real awareness of this, I didn't realize I was actually asking one of the most important and critical philosophical questions that a person could ask. And that is the problem of evil. So while we'll get into that specifically later on in the episode, this is the basis for why some people might say God doesn't exist, because something bad happens. And it could be something relatively expected or small, you could say, with a passing of a grandparent. And I'm sure I know that there's been plenty of people who have experienced far greater hurts and pains in their life than I did when I lost my last living grandparent at 9. I definitely concede that, but it was a real thing that I was going through at the time. I was really struggling with this concept of I don't have any grandparents anymore. My parents are a little bit older than the average parent. My parents had me and my sister when they were 39 and 41, so it's a little late to the game. They had my brother at a relatively normal age at around 30. But most of my schoolmates, they all had their grandparents because they were a solid 10 years younger, right? They weren't, quite at that age where they were getting ready to go. And in many cases, they had all of their grandparents, not just, some, they had all of them. And so while I'm 9 years old, I lose my last one, and I'm just feeling really, at a loss, compared to those around me, and just kind of feeling gypped and cheated out of an experience that I should have had, right? And again, you know, people use these types of situations in their life, and it could be far worse or maybe even not as bad, to say, well, this is a bad thing, or maybe something far worse, like I said, and, you know, say, well, this was evil. You think about somebody getting abused in various ways or murdered, not just dying of leukemia, as my grandfather passed away of. And you think, you know, these people will go and say, like, well, if these evil things are happening, well, where's God? Where's God in all this? And if God exists, then he should be there to stop it or prevent it in some way. And because it happened, and because God didn't stop it, that must mean he doesn't exist, because if he was all-powerful and all-good like we assume he is, then he would have stepped in. So because he didn't step in, he must not be real. He must not be there. Or at the very least, you know, he must not be all-powerful and all-good, and therefore not worthy of my worship. And so that is the typical objection that spurns from this question, God, why did you let that happen? And it was the exact objection that I had as I, you know, a few years later, as I got into high school and I started really thinking about this and getting exposed to other people's worldviews and ways of thinking, I just started thinking, man, God doesn't, he doesn't exist. He must not. Because if he was all good and all powerful and he was in control, then this wouldn't have happened. And yeah, easy. God doesn't exist. It was easier for me to process it at that point, I think, because of that. But the thing that kind of logically butts up against this objection is that without God, there can be no objective morality. And what I mean by that is that if God does not exist, then you're forced to believe in some form of naturalism, that the universe and the world around us came here from natural, unguided processes. As an atheist, that is definitely what you believe in. If you're a naturalist of some sort, maybe not an atheist, I'm not sure how many significant ways there are to differentiate the two, but I believe that there probably could be, if we were to think that out. But you know, essentially, as a naturalist or an atheist, you believe that we got here through no guided process, through no purpose of a caring, loving God. And so, in that case, we are just a random collection of molecules that just happened to form into a coherent, consistent species that evolved and dominated this planet of randomly collected molecules filled with randomly collected molecules of different life forms. Grass and trees and cockroaches and fish and birds and lions and tigers and bears, oh my. There's nothing really significantly different from one to the other from us. It's just another different life form, that is a random collection of molecules, and the only thing separating one or the other is just survivability, adaptability, and the way that they can continue to survive despite other obstacles and other harsh situations. So, you know, on that kind of worldview, if you run over a squirrel, which I've unfortunately done before, if you step on a cockroach, if you cut down and burn a tree for a campfire, if you beat a two-year-old, or if you gun down a family of four, all of these things have the same and equal moral value if you're an atheist or if you're a naturalist. Because again, there's nothing separating, there's nothing making you and I special, right? And by you and I mean human beings. Obviously, I don't think that there are any monkeys or cats or fish listening to this podcast. We're all humans listening to this. Maybe you agree with the premise of what I'm saying. Maybe you don't. Doesn't matter. But if we are just a random collection of molecules, there is nothing significantly special about us. We could have just as easily existed or not existed. There was no purpose behind our living. It was just and in most cases, you're forced into kind of a predetermined set of actions. If we're just a series of biochemical robots, if you will. It was just a matter of time and just the random, seemingly random order of events on a cosmic scale that would eventually allow for life to evolve on this planet. And everything we say and do, as well as every other planet, plant or animal on this planet, everything that it does is all just a series of biochemical reactions, and it's not really free will. So that's another thing that you typically, if you think through the logical implications of atheism or naturalism, that's kind of what you're left with. And it's not meant to be disparaging. There's really smart atheists out there who have really thought through these issues and come to those conclusions and determined that there is no such thing as free will, and there is no such thing as objective morality. But I think that the problem here is that we all kind of inherently know that objective morality exists. We know that there is the difference between right and wrong. You know, watch the news. I'm sure you'll be able to make at least half a dozen different judgments on something that is right and something that is wrong. Whether that's your opinion or whether you feel it is just objectively right or wrong, you can make several judgments as you watch a 30 or 60 minute news program on right or wrong. You know, people are dying because some wealthy individual refuses to give up their billions to be able to help people that are starving. You know, you can say that is objectively wrong. Or people are dying because someone is being violent, and they are going on a killing spree or rampage of some sort, and they're just killing someone out of cold-blooded murder. You know, that is objectively wrong. Somebody being hurt and abused because there's a family member who puts their own sexual appetite above the mental and physical well-being of a child in their home. These things are objectively wrong. And nobody, whether you're an atheist or not, whether you believe in God or not, nobody's going to suggest that these things are right or wrong. There's not going to be any disagreement. Everybody's going to be in agreement that these things are objectively wrong. These things are just wrong all the time, full stop. Never any cases where cold-blooded murder, rape, or, you know, abuse or violence of any kind is just justified against an innocent individual. You know, there's no moral line separating all of us at this point. We all agree in these things. And the struggle at this point is just finding a legitimate grounding for that. And I would suggest to you that if you think through your worldview, if you don't believe in God, you're kind of doomed to this life, this worldview that does not believe in objective morality in the first place. And so when you turn around and say, well, you know, because there's evil in the world, that's a reason why God doesn't exist, you're actually in contradiction with yourself. Because if you acknowledge that there is good and evil, there's a source for both. There is a source for both. And for a naturalist or an atheist, you don't believe in supernatural sources or unseen, unknown, immaterial sources. You believe in natural, physical sources of some sort, whether it's an energy or a physical presence. You believe in that. And so, but you also, unnatural forces, they're concepts, good and evil. And if you only believe in what you physically can see and touch and, you know, experience with the five senses, whatnot, then you're automatically, categorically, kind of out of the running with being able to suggest that anything is right or wrong in this world. You can prefer that things are right or wrong. You can prefer that things be or not be the way that you suggest. But you cannot say objectively that something is just right or something is just wrong. So I encourage you to think through that. And the other side of things is that, you know, again, as I gave this speech in downtown Oberlin, if for those who aren't aware, Oberlin is a very liberal, well-educated, small college town. There is a college called Oberlin College that is the main draw and anchor for that town, drives a lot of business, owns tons of properties in the area. It is very, you know, lucrative venture. And so people come from all over the world to be able to go and attend that college and study the liberal arts. And so the natural assumption, and you know, I can say this from firsthand experience by being in the area of a small, well-educated city like Oberlin, and I'm sure you, if you don't hold this view yourself, you can probably go, you know, not too far to be able to find people who do hold this view, that if you're well-educated, then you're probably less likely to believe in God, and that highly educated people just tend to acknowledge that God doesn't exist. Because if you have all the facts and information and you can process that, you're mentally capable of processing that, you are able to come to the conclusion God's not necessary, he doesn't exist. The facts and evidence point to that, and there's that. And so it's easy to get the bad impression that if you're smart, then naturally you're probably less likely to believe in God. And if you're not as smart, then naturally you might be more inclined to believe in God because maybe you're not able to understand or process all the complex information that points towards God not being real. Well, to that person, I would suggest that, or I would point out, rather than suggest, I would point out that only until recently, philosophical, religious, historical, and educated thought were all intertwined, and they were all focused on people who were theists. In fact, some of the smartest people in history were professing Christians. You can look to someone like Galileo, Isaac Newton, Thomas Aquinas, just to name a few. And there's many, 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 many more. In fact, every major scientific practice and philosophy was founded by Christians. So if you're at all a fan of science, then you owe a debt of gratitude to Christianity, because Christian scientists were the ones who pioneered every single major facet and aspect of science. So it's not at all the case that historically speaking that smart people don't believe in God. In fact, historically speaking, traditionally, the smartest people in the world have been confessing Christians. In fact, too, the another interesting point, the founders of America were all theists, and many of them were Christians. In fact, belief in God was the linchpin upon which we assert that all men are created equal. And obviously today we would say all people are created equal as we properly expand that definition. And although we've frequently fallen short of that righteous declaration here in the U.S., it would have zero logical foundation without the assumption that objective morality exists, which is something atheists cannot claim, again, as I explained earlier. To take it a step further, Judeo-Christian belief is the only major religion to affirm that all people are inherently equal and valuable. You know, when you look at some other religions, they do not at all have that, or share that same notion that everyone's just inherently equal. You need to get to a Judeo-Christian belief system to be able to get that in most major religions, or I should say outside of most major religions, because, you know, between differentiation in value to people based on their gender or based on their social class or economic status, you know, most religions, historically speaking, have differentiated between people's value and other aspects of them that they cannot always control, or things that they are not always born into. And so only in the Judeo-Christian belief system do you get that just everybody is equal. There is nothing that separates me inherently from the billionaire, the millionaire, the middle class working person, to the lower class working person, to the poor person who doesn't know where their next meal is coming from to be able to feed their entire family living on less than a dollar a day in the most rural parts of the world. There's nothing inherently that separates me from any of those people. And you don't get that in just about every religion, period. Definitely not from all the major religions. You don't get that until you step into the Judeo-Christian worldview. No doubt we've all met people, or you've heard people say things along the line of, you know, I have my truth and you have yours, kind of suggesting that truth is a fluid, right? You know, you can believe in what you want to believe, I'll believe in what I want to believe, and as long as we don't, you know, spend time arguing with each other or trying to say how one of us is right and the other one's wrong, then we can all just live and be happy. And so inherently that type of person will say that truth doesn't exist. Okay. And to that, if they, you know, for someone who's saying, making the statement, quote, truth does not exist, end quote, that statement alone has its own little issues, because you have the right to turn around and just ask that person, okay, well, is your statement true? And naturally they're going to want to say, well, yeah, it is. Well, they're making a truth claim. They're claiming that their statement, truth does not exist, is true, and that a claim that truth does exist is false. So it's a self-defeating statement. It doesn't really make sense when you really think about it. It just involves inherent logical contradiction. And you just think about it, okay, if truth didn't exist, let's think about things mathematically speaking. You know, if 1 + 1 did not always equal 2, right? If that was not a true statement, always true, never changing. If that was not the case, then think about it. We never could have gone to the moon, right? We could never do complex math. We could never build structures. We could not do geometry, trigonometry, calculus, because we depend on things being absolutely true. We depend on things just not changing throughout time, and or from place to place or from culture to culture. Things need to be true for us to be able to do math. Things need to be true for us to live life, right? When I go to sit down in the chair that I'm sitting in right now, I expect it to be true that the chair is strong enough to hold me, right? And if that changed from time to time, if it was not always true that this chair is strong enough to hold me at any given point, then I could expect to fall. But we don't think that. Most times, assuming the chair is soundly built, you know, just about every single time you sit down in a chair, you expect it to hold you. And that's because the chair is structurally sound to be able to hold you. It is true that that chair can hold you. So if truth changed, we couldn't live, right? It's important to think those things over. I'm going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about where this notion of flexible or bendable or malleable truth comes from. So I'll be right back. Hey, everyone. I'm back. So we're going to keep going here. When I went off there, we before the break, we talked about truth and how it could be flexible or malleable, and that's the view that a lot of people today take on truth. And it's usually coming from a place of they don't want you and they to have to be arguing about what is right and what is wrong, or they don't want to face facts, or they aren't comfortable with that inherent, you know, conflict between two people as they weigh out and discuss, you know, who's right and who's wrong. And so I can understand the basis for somebody's feelings for that. They don't want to turn around and have that conflict with other people if they can avoid it. But the problem is that truth does exist. Where do we get this notion that truth doesn't exist? Because it's not just a recent thing. You actually have to go back a little more than 100 years ago, about 120, 140 years ago, to when a German philosopher named Friedrich Nietzsche existed. He, German philosopher, he was raised as a Christian, and he was partly, maybe mostly responsible for the idea of the flexibility or malleability of truth, this concept that we see so frequently and commonly today. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He has a lot of quotes out there. You can Google Friedrich Nietzsche quotes and you'll get a whole lot of results. Let me share some of his more famous ones or infamous ones, depending on how you look at it. The one I thought that's jumped out to me the most was, "Woman was God's second mistake," obviously implying that making man was God's first mistake, but the fact that he's focusing on the woman was just, it kind of shows a bit of a sexist attitude, a bit of misogyny there. Another quote, "To live is to suffer, to survive is to find some meaning in the suffering," which is not exactly a kind of world life outlook that I would want to be modeling or would want other people to be referring to. He's probably most famously known for stating God is dead, and for those of us in our Christian circles, this is where the title of the movie God's Not Dead comes from. It's from a longer quote that Nietzsche has, that he's something that he penned and was made more famous by atheist scientists, or philosophers rather, as they went to try to follow him and model after him. So obviously you can tell his religious affiliation at this point. He's quoted as saying, "There are no facts, only interpretations." Sound familiar? He's also quoted as saying, "Sometimes people don't want to hear the truth because they don't want their illusions destroyed. And you can kind of tell his motive for that, but I wonder if this isn't true for himself. Couple more. He's quoted as saying, "You have your way, I have my way. As for the right way, the correct way, and the only way, it does not exist." So that would seem to stand in stark contrast to what Jesus said when he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me," right? So, you know, Nietzsche is butting right up against the Lord Most High in this case. Not so sure that'd be a place where I'd want to be. And perhaps his best quote, which I think highlights the irony of his standpoint and view on life. He's quoted as saying, "The worst readers are those who behave like plundering troops. They take away a few things they can use, dirty and confound the remainder, and revile the whole." And when you compare that quote on its own to, "You have your way, I have my way, as for the right way, the correct way, the only way doesn't exist," or, you know, "There are no facts, only interpretations," you hold that last statement up against those other ones, it's kind of interesting, the ironic contradiction here, right? And so, you know, when you say that, you know, he doesn't like the type of reader that just picks pieces out of what they read and twist and reinterpret it and then defile the entire thing that's been written, well, I would dare say that he's done this, and many people do this, with the Bible, right? Many times you hear people pull the Bible out of context and quote a single scripture from Leviticus or Deuteronomy or Numbers or something of that nature. And they say, well, this is what all Christians have to believe, is because they quoted something far way out of context. And so what I would suggest is that, yeah, we take heed to his last quote. I think his last quote was actually quite profound and very smart. "Worst readers are those who behave like plundering troops. They take away a few things they can use, dirty and confound the remainder, and revile the whole." And so I would encourage all Christians listening to this, and non-Christians, if you're analyzing the Bible and looking at it for some purpose, is that you take the Bible in its whole entirety and in its context. Don't find a verse or a scripture or a couple, you know, verses that are completely removed from their historical and philosophical, religious context, theological context even as well, and then turn around and make your judgments based on it. You need to understand the work as a whole. And as good-thinking Christians, we should do the same towards atheists and naturalists, people who are opponents of the faith. The last thing that we should be doing, and you can see this on full display in our political arena, which is just, it sickens me from an intellectual standpoint, is you see people on the left and the right completely strawmanning the other position and acting like that's the truth. You know, they say, oh, well, this politician is a piece of crap because he supports this policy, you know, or this politician is a piece of crap because he opposes this policy. And, you know, they all strip away the things that they don't want to talk about, and they highlight the things that they want to talk about and pretend that that is a fair and accurate representation of everything. You know, when it's very hard to find any single piece of legislation, no matter how poorly or greatly you look at it or admire it, it's very hard to find any single piece of legislation that is just 100% all bad. And I mean that to every conservative person that's listening. I mean that to every liberal person that's listening. Green New Deal, good example. There's plenty of things about the Green New Deal that any common sense individual could support. Read the Green New Deal. Problem is, we've heard about it so much from Fox News and the right that the Green New Deal is just this terrible, nasty, liberal left democratic thing that no Republican or conservative wants to talk about it. Conversely, Donald Trump's policies, you know, have been so reviled and so hated and so mischaracterized as being completely and totally racist and everything filled with hate, that there's a lot of things about his policies that I think that the average American, had you not known that it'd be attached to Donald Trump, would have actually supported. And there's plenty of more examples, and I just use those two because from the left and from the right, they're probably the most emotionally and and politically charged of examples I could possibly use. So I hope I've gotten somebody's blood pressure raised up a little bit. And would encourage you too, that if you're a liberal, look into some of the policies, actual policies that Trump implemented, and see if there's some things that you can acknowledge that are at least okay there. And likewise to the conservative, I would encourage you to go read the Green New Deal. It is far from the liberal anti-God grab bag that a lot of people try to make it out to be. And that's just what happens when we just listen to one side of our sources and we just allow our opinions to be driven by radical views on either side. And neither is helpful to good conversation. And the same thing happens to the Bible. Same thing happens for Christians and non-Christians as we engage in discussion and debate with each other. We need to understand exactly what the other one believes, and we need to understand what the implications are. Notice when I talked about the moral implications of an atheist and a naturalist worldview, I didn't say, see, without God, all of you atheists and naturalists are just evil people. You don't believe in right and wrong. Of course it's wrong. Just about every single human being on this planet believes in objective morality and right and wrong. And the reason that I make that point in saying, hey, you know, I'm not saying that you are morally different on any of these subjects than me is because most people would affirm, yeah, rape is wrong, murder is wrong, abusing people is wrong, withholding your gross overflow of your own wealth and depriving someone else who's just trying to survive today, not to mention tomorrow, that's also wrong. You know, as Christians, I think that all of us should at least acknowledge that. You know, I can't speak to anyone else, but I would assume that most people would agree with everything I just said, right? And you don't need to necessarily believe in God to believe those things, to think those things. But where my bone is that a logical, moral, philosophical foundation for those thoughts, right? I when I say these things, I'm not trying to disparage people or trying to find a way to make the other guy look as bad as I possibly can. That's not the point. In fact, if I'm looking to lead people to Christ, if I'm looking to persuade people to believe in my view, then I should try to be as generous and gracious and afford as many opportunities of agreement between me and the person on the other side that I can, so that we can have substantive, good, positive, progressive conversation. So I'd encourage you to do that same. So after we've looked at Nietzsche's outlook and his philosophical views, here's something else that we should take into account, and that's his life history. Turning back to Nietzsche. Nietzsche lived in Germany as Nazism was on the rise. His father passed away at 5 years old. He was extremely smart. He served as a military medic in the late 1800s and caught multiple diseases, which would eventually kill him. His sexist and anti-Semitic attitudes killed relationships that he had with people around him. He was so sick that he couldn't work by 35, and he lost his mind by the time he was 45, and he died in his mid-50s alone. So my question to you, you know, is it wise to follow a man like this and revere him? You know, in my opinion, he's to be pitied and not to be followed. You think about the things that he's gone through. You know, it's no wonder that he came to the conclusions that he came to while in the absence of people who were there to support and love him and be able to shepherd him through these difficult moments, like I would hope that most of us as Christians do. But again, my opinion, this person is not to be revered or followed, but to be pitied. And so that the foundation upon which somebody is making their decisions can reveal a lot about what they think, who they are, and should be taken into account when you consider how much weight to put behind somebody's words. But that kind of background and his type of thinking did eventually outlive him, right? People would pick up his books and, for whatever reason, thought that what he had to say was good. And this type of thinking ended up leading to objections like the brain in the vat theory. Okay, well, what's the brain in the vat theory if you've never heard of it? That theory goes that we're all not really living. You're not really sitting in your car listening to this podcast or at your desk or walking around or exercising or doing whatever it is that you're doing, maybe cleaning the house, mowing the lawn, whatever. You're not really doing this. You're not really living. You're not really breathing. You're not really, you know, dealing with whatever ups and downs that you've got going on in your life. All that's illusory. All of it's fake. Really, you're just a brain in a vat of chemicals being stimulated by direct or, in, you know, or random or non-random, doesn't matter, impulses of electricity made to make you think that you're living, but you're not really living. And so to that person, you know, and these are, that's a real objection that some people have. Well, how do you know we're not a brain in a vat? I guess my response to that would be, do you have any evidence to suggest that we are a brain in a vat? Do you have any good reason to suggest that that is logical to conclude or to come to? And I would venture to guess that that there isn't any. I would ask you that if you really think you're a brain in a vat, then go ahead and break the glass and step out in front of a bus or go, you know, jump out of a plane. And I'm not really suggesting that, so please don't hurt yourself or kill yourself. But the point is that no one's ever really gonna put enough faith or trust in the brain in the vat theory to go ahead and test it and end the experiment, right? Because if we're just really a brain in a vat, this is all just torturous, right? There's some good, yeah, but, you know, if there's no purpose to it, then why do it? You know, why even give the scientist or the alien or whoever it is that's running this theory in the first place, why give them the pleasure of that, of the extra data? Just end the program and let it be done. But we don't really believe that, right? But the fact that there are people who do believe that, or do believe that that's a reasonable objection should, I guess, I mean, not a guess, I mean, it definitely points back to what Paul wrote when he wrote the book of Romans. It says, for they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. You know, it just speaks to the depraved state of the human mind that some people will go at any length to avoid belief in God or to avoid belief in the logical things that we can see and assume of what's around us. You know, what lengths will people go to refuse the belief in God? There are so many. And on a separate note, why do we revere things more than God? Why do we revere lifestyles more than God? You know, why do we put some kind of value, any kind of value, on the person who is out spending so much money, more money than they have business spending, on personal pleasures that are nowhere near worth the amount of money that they're throwing out the window, getting drunk, having sex, partying all the time, doing things that ultimately are destroying themselves and likely other people, for what? What have you gained by it? You've gained a memory, an experience, maybe? You've probably hurt somebody's feelings in the process, maybe many people's. At the very least, you've wasted your time and your efforts, and spent it very inefficiently. And you think about, you know, what you could have done instead of spending, you know, let's say $1,000 on throwing the wildest party that you could possibly, you know, or $2,000 maybe, you hire a DJ, you get, you know, a bunch of alcohol and you just invite a whole bunch of people over and just keep the doors of your house wide open so anybody who hears the music can just come and party, and you got all sorts of crazy things happening, and for what? For one night? For what? And that same $1,000 or $2,000 for any of my longer time listeners, you know that type of investment could really help. That could help hundreds of people in another country, literally hundreds of people, survive a week with food. You know, $1,000 to $2,000, I could easily take that and feed 100 to 200 families in Cambodia, as an example. Again, for those of you guys who've been following my podcast for a while, you know that my wife and I have a heart for that area, and we regularly give to people in that part of the world, and we're grateful that we're able to make you know, a benefit to the people in those areas of the world. But I mean, what's the point of doing what you just did by going and just wasting your money? What are you doing? You know, why do we revere that? We could easily do the opposite and have a much longer term and positive effect on other people in the world. Another issue that we have with the way that atheists view Christianity and faith in general is that they often mischaracterize the word faith to mean blind, illogical trust. And that's not how true people of faith, I can't, you know, some people definitely do have blind, illogical trust in God, and when you actually dig deeper, they really have no foundation in any kind of belief system. You know, God is just something that they've always believed in, and you ask them to explain why, they can't. Well, it's how I was raised. Okay, well, your foundation is probably really not in the Lord, or in whatever belief system you have. You just believe that God's real, and you don't care to think any more deeply into it, whether they're objections to belief in God or whether they're arguments for belief in God. It doesn't matter to you. So that would be an example of blind illogical trust. But for people who really do believe in the Lord or believe in God, doesn't even have to be Jesus at that point, faith is not defined as blind illogical trust. It is defined as evidence. It is defined as a history of repeated patterns of trustworthiness that somebody can now put their trust in that person. And to that, I would liken it to, let's say, my relationship with my wife. Right now, I'm sitting in my office, and as I'm recording this podcast, and I'm the only person in this room. The home sounds pretty quiet, which is a little bit odd when you have a wife from Cambodia, who she tends to be quite loud when she wants to be from time to time. God love her. And I've got two toddlers. I have a 2 and a 3-year-old, and both boys, and they both take their character after their mother in many ways. And so they can be quite loud and rambunctious. And for the house to be quiet is a little bit weird. And so while I cannot see my wife, and I don't know that she is currently at home or at home with my two kids, I have full trust that she is not out cheating on me right now. I believe that. And if you were to suggest to me that she was cheating on me right now, I would not believe you, because I know her. I trust her. I built a relationship with her. I've known this woman for, you know, 6 years now. And I've been married to her for 4.5. You know, I know this person very well. And I know the life that we're trying to build together. And if you were to suggest to me that she's out, you know, having relations with another person, I'd say, no, that's not in her character. And I could be wrong, of course. And all of us could be wrong. You know, anything could happen when your eyes are not physically on the person that you're thinking about. You know, all these things would be true. But my relationship and my experiences with my wife tells me that I can have faith that she's being faithful to me. And likewise, her experiences with me can be the same, that she knows that even though she's not with me, she knows I'm not out running around on her, because we both have faith in each other. We both have experiences with each other that has led us to trust each other when we can't see each other. And I would suggest that the same is true for people who believe emphatically and deeply in God, is that they have faith in God. They have trust in God because their experiences have led them to that conclusion that they can trust him. So I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and we will finish things up. Okay, everyone, we're back. We're going to finish things up now. So after talking about, you know, faith and what that means, what that truly means from a biblical standpoint, not from the, again, the straw man version of what people tend to imagine the word faith to mean in a religious context, you know, let's move over to another objection that can be made, and that the universe and its endless size and scope is an inefficient use of resources. And some people say that that is a reason to argue that God does not exist, because if God did exist, he would use his resources a little bit more efficiently, that he would turn around and he would, if we're really the only thing that he created, and he created, everything's all about us, da 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 da, then, you know, he would confine his efforts to just making the galaxy, that were in the best, or maybe even smaller than the galaxy, making the galaxy much smaller. Just make the sun and the solar system, and that's it. And we're just here, and that's all that there is of the known universe. And we should just really be focusing on Jesus, right? You know, that's you know, can be an argument for that. You know, it's just an inefficient use of resources. If we're the only thing here, then why this massively expansive universe? And you can look out, and, you know, there was a recent exercise that NASA did with the Hubble telescope, and they just pointed at this really, 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 really tiny percentage spot in the sky and just narrowed it there just to see what Hubble could see really far away. And what it saw is, after it zoomed past the planets and the stars and everything that was in our galaxy, and you see this little dark spot, and it continues to zoom in and zoom in and zoom in, and you just see all these like tiny little lights, and you just see them getting a little bit bigger, and you can just see in the background, in this very, very tiny, it's like if you were to just point your finger at any point in the room, right, and you were to zoom in just the size of your fingertip on the wall or the ceiling or the floor of wherever you pointed, and then you zoom into that and you just see hundreds of little galaxies, and they're obviously not little, they're massive, hundreds of galaxies in that one point. And you can look around and you can see every direction you look, that same thing. You just see the wow, like we're inside of a galaxy. And if we really look into any direction of space, we can see just, oh my gosh, so many galaxies in just this tiny little view. And you see, wow, how expansive the universe is. And people say, okay, well, that's an argument against God, because if God really existed, he wouldn't be just needlessly creating all this stuff, right? Well, that argument only really applies to a being, or any being like us, of limited power and resources. But again, the atheist or the non-believer needs to remember that the God of the Bible, the God that we believe in, is a limitless, all-powerful creature with endless scope. He's without time, he's without space, he's without matter, he's an unembodied mind. And so his resources and ability to do things are far more expansive than what we can even think or imagine. And when you think of just about, you know, everywhere, there's just hundreds of galaxies and every little pinpoint direction that we could possibly think to look, it's just amazing of how good and great God is and how big he is, you know. And so that creates another, I touched on another objection there, is that the only rational minds, you know, real thinking individual minds that we know are that are in bodies. And, you know, God is, you know, by definition, an unembodied mind. And so since we've never seen it before, it can't exist. And to that objection, I would say, you know, okay, if you're going to say God doesn't exist because he's an unembodied mind and the only minds that we know are embodied, so therefore it's far simpler to say that he doesn't exist because he's different, too different, in fact, well, then I would suggest to you that we should stop looking for alien life outside of Earth. Any kind of life, whether it's microscopic or not, because the only life we've seen is on this planet. So to suggest that there's only, that the only life that ever will exist is on this planet, and that, you know, that should suggest that there is no such thing as alien life. Certainly not sentient life, but there is no such thing as life at other places, because the only place we have seen life is here on Earth. And as I say that, I think you can logically kind of spot the issues with that. It's just because we haven't seen life elsewhere outside of this planet doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I don't know what your belief in alien life is, and it doesn't really matter. Belief in alien life has no bearing on whether God exists and whether he created us as unique and wonderful individuals. You know, if the Romulans and the Klingons and the Borg and all of them, if they all exist, if Chewbacca's out there, you know, getting ready to take over the world, over the universe, and Yoda's trying to stop them, you know, if all these things out there are real, I'd be willing to bet that either these creatures are not sentient, meaning they're not self-aware like we are, or that God's appeared to them in a similar way that he's appeared to us, and that he will have revealed himself as Christ to them. And so that would be my suggestion to you, if you do believe in alien life, But regardless, it doesn't matter. The point is that, oh, God doesn't exist because he's an unembodied mind. We don't know any unembodied minds, therefore he doesn't exist. Well, we look for alien life pretty consistently, pretty vigorously right now. And just because we haven't found alien life yet, and because the only life we've seen on this earth, or seen is on this earth, does not at all suggest that that's the only place life can exist. So it's a logical contradiction there. The other argument against God is, you know, God is not all-powerful, because if he was, he could make a rock so heavy that he couldn't lift it. And this proposition just involves a logical fallacy either way you look at, because if God could create a rock so heavy he can't lift it, then he's all-powerful and can create this huge, huge thing. Likewise, that would also mean he's not all-powerful, because if he can't lift that rock, then he's not all-powerful. And likewise, if he can't create it, then he's not all-powerful. So it's a logical contradiction. And so, again, this is usually said, well, God can do all things. Well, again, that's kind of a twisting of what we mean as Christians or as people who believe in an all-powerful God say when we say God can do all things. We mean that God can do all things logically possible. You know, we don't mean that he can create logical contradictions by creating a rock so heavy he can't lift it, or creating a married bachelor. You know, these are illogical contradictions. It's not possible. And so in any world, in any kind of idea, so just the things that define one or the other make it impossible for them to coexist. So when we say that God can do all things, it means he can do all things that are logically possible. If you think of a God who is as powerful as the Christian doctrine describes him to be, we can imagine a God who could heal someone from being sick. We can imagine a God that can reverse the death process and bring someone back to life. We can imagine that God can work a miracle in your life and, you know, make your finances work in such a way so that way you're never in lack. We imagine that these things are possible, right? It's not logically contradictory to believe these things. Another point that's kind of interesting is if you were to walk down the road or down the street, sidewalk, whatever, and you would find a watch or a car or a computer, my question to you is, if you find these things, would you assume that it is product of a violent, random act, or that it has a creator? And I think the logical thing is, you see a watch and you're like, oh, that watch was made by somebody. Hopefully it's Rolex, and nobody claims it, and now you got yourself a nice Rolex. You know, you see a car down the road, you know it's made by Mercedes, or it's made by Ford or Chevy, or Dodge or Toyota or Honda. You know, you can look at the emblem and or the body style in some cases, and you can just tell who made that car, and you know it's got a creator. Now you look at a computer, you know how detailed that thing is. It cannot just be a random product of plastic and metal slapped together. You know, it's got an intelligent designer behind it. And why do we think that? Because we see design inherently in how these things are put together. But when the naturalist or the atheist looks at a human being or a plant or the earth or the universe in general, and they say, oh, well, that was just here by a random product of chance. Big bang, boom, no, you know, unguided process, evolution, macroevolution, boom, you know, that's how it all got here. Well, a plant on its own is already more complex than a computer, than a car, than a watch. A plant is able to, without any assistance, without any maintenance, gather light from the atmosphere within itself and initiate chemical reactions, which then provide it nutrients to grow. Its root systems automatically will grow deeper into the ground to be able to bring in water and other nutrients from the soil to be able to facilitate that process. And then through a process called photosynthesis, will expel its waste, which is oxygen, thankfully for us, since we need it. And it works all the time. You don't need to manage most plants in order to get this process to go. Simple thing like a blade of grass or a tree or a bush. And for years and years and years and years, and in many cases, when you think about some of these large trees, hundreds of years, if not more than that, these things just go through this process normally and continue to grow or develop or just, you know, stay in the cycle of survival It does this automatically. Well, a watch will eventually break. A car will break down. A computer will eventually fail. But these things, they go on and on without any maintenance. Okay? So just if you, again, just looking at a blade of grass, you've already encountered something far more complex than a watch or a car or a computer. Then you look at something like, you know, a mouse or a human. You look at something like the entire planet or our galaxy or the universe. These things are far more complex than a watch, a car, or a computer. And so I think we have a right to say, who created these things? They're far too complex to have just happened naturally. And I think we're right to pose that question. Another one. Here's what's called the Kalam cosmological argument. It says a few it's a logical argument for the necessitation of the existence of God, necessity of existence of God. It's just got three premises with a conclusion. Premise number one is that everything that begins to exist has a cause. You think of everything that you know. Everything, literally, everything's got a cause. Okay. The universe, which includes all space, time, and matter, just to make sure we're understanding what our definition is when we say the universe, universe began to exist. A naturalist would look to the Big Bang as its process on which that would happen. Premise number three, therefore the universe has a cause. And when you say a cause, you're insinuating a cause outside of itself, right? A mouse does not create itself. A chicken does not create itself. A star does not create itself. It is dependent on outside forces and interactions to be able to do that. Some of them you could say are unguided. Maybe you don't believe they're unguided. Maybe it's all guided by God. Maybe God set up certain systems and whatnot to work in a certain way so that way they happen regularly on their own. Kind of like a blade of grass has its own system that functions. You know, you could think these things, and it's okay, it's fine. You know, but that is what you assume by saying it has a cause, meaning an outside cause. Okay, well, what lives outside of space, time, and matter that could cause the universe to exist? Think about it. The cause of the universe needs to be necessarily spaceless, because in order to create space, you cannot be within it. Chicken and the egg, right? You have to be outside of space to be able to create it. You need to be timeless. Again, you cannot exist in time if you're going to create time. Immaterial. Everything here is material. So in order to create material, you need to be immaterial. Obviously, you need to go powerful. You need to be powerful. That I think that goes without saying said. And you need to be personal. There needs to be an intention behind it. Right? So if something created the universe, let's not say it's the Christian God at this point, let's just say some being, something created everything, there's got to be a purpose. Why go through the exercise? Why go through the process in the first place unless there's a purpose? And I would suggest to you that this is a perfect description of God, specifically the God of the Bible. Something else that's interesting to note, and you might find this strange hearing a Christian say this, but that Christianity can be proven false. No doubt every Christian right now, as I say this, is cringing, like, whoa, Jim, what do you mean? And every atheist is like, okay, well, tell me, I want to know, how can I prove Christianity false? You just have to do one thing. It's very simple. Might not be that easy, but it's simple. You need to produce the body of Jesus. If you could produce the body of Jesus, you could prove Christianity verifiably, objectively false. As Christians, we don't believe that God rode spiritually into heaven, that Jesus' spirit left the planet, and his body stayed here. And that was the claim that Jesus made. Think of this. If Jesus was really a charlatan, he was really a liar, he wasn't really God, or people were making up the religion, wouldn't it have been a lot smarter to say that Jesus said he would spiritually rise from the dead? How could you prove that wrong? How could you prove that wrong? If Jesus claimed, I will spiritually rise from the dead. If you kill me, I will spiritually rise from the dead. How could you prove that wrong? You couldn't. Anybody could say, well, I believe a spirit is living in me. You know, Holy Spirit's living in me. That's what he meant. And Jesus is alive. He's still alive because he's spiritually alive within me. Yeah, his body might be dead, but he's spiritually alive in me. Who could refute that? Nobody could. No one could. Okay? But Jesus didn't say that. He said, I'm going to bodily rise into heaven. And then he did it. And that's why, despite massive persecution for hundreds of years, Christianity continued to grow and eventually dominated the planet. And has so ever since. So I think that bears some meditation, we'll say. Scientifically minded folk might assert that the universe created itself, which is clearly contradictory. You think about it. To say that X created X makes the assumption that X already exists in the first place, and therefore isn't a valid explanation for the existence of X, since nothing has ever been the cause of its own existence. Which defeats the purpose of making the statement in the first place and only proves that nonsense is still nonsense, even if it's uttered by a scientist. We are the only form of life ever to walk this planet to aspire, to be creative, to wonder why, to make moral choices, to wonder how did I get here. To be sentient is the short term that we give to that. And we're one of the youngest species, according to evolutionary science, we're one of the youngest species to roam this planet. So how is that possible that for some species, hundreds and hundreds of millions of years have never grown past basic animalistic capacities? How? Unless we're different. Unless we're special. Unless we're unique in some very drastic way. We've seen no sign that any creature is coming anywhere close or is on the trajectory in any way to being like us. We see no sign of it. We have, on a low end, 20,000 examples of New Testament letters, books, and if you include some of the portions, like the fragments, not just the portions, like a page, we would consider that another example. But if you would include this fragments, you're talking over 30,000, 24 to 30 plus thousand examples of New Testament documents that are in roughly 99% agreement with each other on what they say. No matter what time period you go and you find those examples of biblical text, New Testament text, this is just New Testament, mind you, just New Testament. No matter what time you go, you can go 5 years after the crucifixion, 500 years, 1,000, 1,500, any time in between. Any handwritten copy of the New Testament, be it a gospel, a letter, any book, any fragment, any portion, they're 99% in agreement with each other. There's literally about a 1% difference between any given portion. And that 1% has no bearing on any Christian doctrine. So when people try to tell you, maybe you're a Christian, you've heard, oh, I don't believe in the Bible because it's like the game of telephone. People say that to you, I encourage you, stand up and say, hey, that's not true. You can go back as early as we can possibly go. The earliest example, which is just a few years separated from Jesus' ascension into heaven. Just a few years separated from that to up until about 500 years ago. Before the printing press was invented, right? And we didn't have to rely on people manually writing things out anymore. At any point in between, you could pick a random piece of text, any a random example of New Testament writing, and hold it up to your Bible that you can buy in a store or online or hold in your hand today, and it's 99% in agreement. So if we've really done that, if we've really changed and transformed the text throughout the years, and it's just been this game of telephone, then you would expect there to be differences, vast differences, and those differences don't exist. So I mentioned earlier about my grandfather passing when I was a young boy and not having the opportunity to really get to know him or get to live a life with any grandparents into my early adult years, as most of my most people of my age do, you know, or at least they get to reach their adulthood before they have to start dealing with loss of grandparents. And I had lost all of them by the time I was 2, except for one. Both my mom's parents died before I was born. My grandmother on my father's side passed away when I was 2, and then my grandfather passed away when I was 9. My dad's dad passed away when I was 9. I'd almost completely lost out on this experience of having grandparents, and I felt very cheated. I felt very alone and sad and frustrated. And I turned to God and I said, "Why did this happen? Why did you let this happen?" And what this comes down to is free will. You could ask this question endlessly. God, why do you let these things happen? Why do you let people get raped and beaten and murdered? Why do you let evil people prosper? Why do you let things happen in this world that are just not good? God, why do you let these things happen? And again, the answer comes down to free will. God gave us free will to choose how to live our life, what choices to make. And as difficult as that might be for us to grapple with and wrestle with, as it was for me, I went through this myself. I'm not just saying this as some cold, callous person who never really thought about this. This is what caused me to be an atheist for like a decade, okay? I went from being a person who had blind faith in God to an atheist for about a decade, hating Christians, hating people who believed in God because of this very issue, because I had thought through it very thoroughly. And I did not want to believe in God because if God was real and he allowed these things, that wasn't a God I wanted to worship. But God created free will. This was something that he designed us in this universe to have. And so the question is why? Why would he allow these things? And while I will not sit here and pretend to tell you I know every reason why God let every bad thing happen, I would not be so arrogant, presumptuous to say this. To say a reason why, maybe to you, you're thinking of something bad that happened to you or that happened to somebody you know. I would not be so arrogant to presume to say I know why that happened. But what I would suggest to you is that nothing bad happens in this world without a purpose. And while we can turn around and say, okay, well, what good thing could have come from this or that? Let me give you an example. Let me give you an illustration. Let's say I'm walking down the street. And I go to cross the road, and I didn't look close enough, okay? Or somebody wasn't driving very carefully, right? And a car jumps the curb or runs into me, and I survive. Miraculously, I survive. I go to the hospital, I get hurt and broken, but I recover. And I attribute that recovery, I attribute my surviving to God's being good to me. Now, you could think that's illogical or unreasonable. It doesn't matter. But this bad thing now, for whatever reason, this bad thing plus my previous life experiences and genetic makeup, you could say, has now led to me believing in Jesus. And on the Christian worldview, knowing God, believing in God, is the best thing that you could possibly do. And in that sense, a bad thing has now resulted in a good thing. Again, if you're going to question why God allows bad things to happen, you got to walk into Christian doctrine and let us explain to you why this could be. Okay? God could have let this bad thing happen to me because it could result in a good thing. And so, again, I can't speak to the specific scenarios of your life or someone else's life. I can't speak to the different things that could have gone on that you might be thinking of. But all it takes is for there to be a good, legitimate reason. And what I would suggest to you is that as you're trying to think through this and try to understand why did God let this thing happen to you in your life, or why did he let this other thing to happen to somebody else in their life, as you're trying to think about it, just hold that thought in the back of your head as you reasonably and logically try to think through the Christian worldview, as you try to think through what some of the things I've said today, what they imply. Okay? And maybe that explanation wasn't that satisfactory. I can acknowledge that. I'm not entirely convinced I'm the best at explaining these types of issues. Cause to me, as now that I've grown older, I've gotten the answers to that side of the question, Like I said, that was one of the things that kept me from believing in God in the first place. But now I've gotten the answers that satisfy me. Maybe that's not satisfying to you. I can acknowledge that. I've run across a whole lot of questions, like the brain in the vat theory. I've never considered that, and I've never considered that to be a good objection to why you shouldn't believe in God. But some people might think that it is, which is why I bring it up. But maybe my explanation isn't good enough for you. Maybe your problem with the problem of evil, which is how it's kind of colloquially known, is deeper than my problem was. That's fine. We all have our different hang-ups. We all have our different places where we really need to dig down and get good answers to. And to that, we can continue to discuss that forever, and we might never get to a solution. Okay, but again, let's step back into that Christian worldview for a moment. You're asking why Jesus, why the Christian God would allow these bad things to happen. And what I would suggest to you is asking a different question along those same lines. And the question I would ask is, what is God doing on a cross? What's God doing on a cross? You see, Christians acknowledge and believe that Jesus jumped on a cross to join us in our suffering, to understand, to experience that, to take it on himself. See, we're not talking about a God who's aloof and just distant from us, distant from our pain, distant from our situation. He's right there. Okay? If God had no desire to be close to us and understand and be near to us in our deepest, darkest, most worst, most depressing and sad and angry moments, if he had no desire to do that, then he never would have jumped on a cross, friends. But he did. He subjected himself, the most powerful being in the universe, put on human flesh, grew up, experienced life as a man, and went to a cross and died, bearing the weight of all sin, past, present, and future, fulfilling hundreds of prophecies along the way. That's what Jesus did. Not because he's distant, but because he's close in our pain. If you've experienced something that's caused you to experience pain, and so much to the point where you doubt God, know, number one, that God's not upset by that. He's not offended by that. He can take it. Okay? He's not put off by you having that thought. But know, number two, that he is not distant. He's there. He's right there for you to turn to. Jesus was the only innocent person to ever live. And he came to pay for our penalty. He paid that penalty for us. And he reaches out to you now and offers love, forgiveness, and acceptance. But you have to act. If I give you a gift, I give you a brand new iPhone, brand new Samsung. Maybe you're not iPhone club. That's fine. I'll pray for you. But if you're not in the iPhone club, now you want a Samsung, right? Or you want the new Google phone, whatever. I give that to you. This is a gift. Or maybe you're a car guy and I hand you the keys to a 69 Mustang, right? Or a 1970 Camaro. Right? Or maybe you like your new luxury cars. Maybe I hand you keys to a brand new Cadillac Escalade, right? Or a Mercedes-Benz, right? I hand you the keys to a brand new house. Or I hand you over a box of a brand new, you know, 70-inch 4K HD, you know, 3D TV, you know, with the blue, everything. All the surround sound. I give you the whole package. And I say, this is yours. But if you never take that from me, you can't claim that. You can't claim ownership of it. Not until you reach out and accept that gift. You need to reach out and take those keys to the car. You need to reach out and say thank you and receive that box, that TV. You need to open up that phone and go to the store and activate it to be able to utilize the gift that has been given to you. Because you can say, oh, well, Jesus died for everybody. Yeah, he did, but you have to accept his sacrifice. You have to accept that gift that he just gave. And if you don't, then you're just as good as the person who just refuses to believe he exists in the first place. Or you're just as good as the person who just refuses the gift. He didn't die passively for you. He died actively for you so that you can actively have a relationship with him, so you can know him and be known by him. And I would encourage you to get to know Jesus a little bit better. Get to know the God of the Bible a little bit better. Study the New Testament. Read it. Read the Gospels. Read them again. Read some of the New Testament letters. Just bounce around. Doesn't matter. Read any of them. Just read. Just get to know the God of the Bible. If you know a friend of yours that's I would define it as a born-again, genuine Christian who might tell you, hey, I'm praying for you, and they don't mean it in a sarcastic or mean way. They're a person who is genuinely looking out for you and trying to share Jesus with you, not for any benefit of their own. You know, if you know somebody like that, or whether maybe there's a church nearby that you know that is an evangelical church or a church that believes in the Bible. Maybe you don't agree with everything they believe or teach, but you know at least that they believe in Jesus, and they at least act decently towards you when you've been able to have interactions with them. I would encourage you to get involved with them and talk to them a little bit about this and try to get to know Jesus a little bit better. I can tell you, after being a Christian for almost 10 years, there's not been a single day where I've regretted it. At this point, I've been a Christian longer than I was an atheist, and I'm grateful for that. And the difference in my life as a Christian compared to when I was an atheist is far different, far better. Peace, acceptance, self-confidence, joy, love, things I had in very rare quantities as an atheist, as somebody who didn't believe in God. And I would encourage you that as I've never regretted a moment for living my life in Christ, I'd encourage you to consider to make that decision yourself. And I'd be willing to bet you won't regret it either. Thanks, guys. God bless.